You are about to participate in the most ambitious culinary experiment ever imagined.
This competition is going to test everything.
Adapt quickly to anything. I mean anything. The wildest day of your life starts right now.
All new 24 and 24 Last Chef Standing. Sunday night at 8 on Food Network. Stream on Max.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
It's very difficult to keep the line between the past and the present.
You believe that someone out of the past can enter and take possession of a living being?
We may be through with the past, but the past is not through with us.
Welcome to the Next Picture Show, a Movie of the Week podcast devoted to a classic film and how it shaped our thoughts on a recent release. I'm Scott Tobias, here with
Keith Phipps.
Our regular co-hosts Tasha Robinson and Genevieve Kosky have gone missing, along with our cats, but we'll amble around for a while and find them in Mexico, maybe. In the meantime, we're broing out with our good friend and longtime co-worker, Noel Murray. Noel, welcome back to the show.
Friends, it is great to be here.
Wow. Seems like it was only yesterday that we were recording something on Nightmare Alley, right? That was the last one?
Yeah, that must have been December, maybe. It's been a while.
It's been a while, but I believe you're familiar with the filmmaker we are talking about today.
I've heard of him, yeah.
So today we're talking about a couple of low-key comic mysteries, including Robert Altman's The Long Goodbye. But given that Noel is a huge Altman fan and considers McCabe and Mrs. Miller his favorite film of all time, or close to it, I wanted to ask you guys a question. What's a non-obvious Altman gem that you'd like to recommend to people, taking films like McCabe and Nashville off the table?
I mean, my favorite kind of unseen Altman film, unfortunately, is not widely available, which is A Perfect Couple, which came towards the end of his 70s era. It's a romantic comedy. It's one of his few films that's kind of set in the modern day in Los Angeles. And I wish that was more available. And if it ever does become so, like if it shows up on TCM or whatever, jump on it, because it is a wonder. But I will go ahead and add my recommendation for a couple of late period Altman films, because I actually think that he really, right towards the end of his career and his life, began sort of funneling his general sort of aesthetic and his obsessions with watching a bunch of people interact and just sort of enjoying having really good actors just kind of bounce off each other. That sort of became what his films were really about. And so I think that two of his final films, The Company and A Prairie Home Companion, both of which are available to stream in various formats, both of which have problematic elements in that The Company has James Franco and The Prairie Home Companion is a Garrison Keillor, two dudes who have been you know, roundly canceled. But nevertheless, they're both really wonderful films. And I think both of them have no plot. It's just kind of Altman just watching people have fun. And they really kind of, I think, speak to what I loved about his aesthetic and his movies. And so, The Company and Prairie Home Companion.
So maybe work backwards in the Altman.
Yeah, exactly.
Keith, what about you?
I'm such a soft touch for Altman that, like, there are movies that people don't like that I'll champion, like Dr. T and the Women, for one. I know it's a reviled movie in some circles, but I don't know, I like it, you know. Even Kansas City, I think Kansas City, but let's I'll go the opposite direction from Noel, though. As I you know, he has such a great run. It's hard in the early 70s, it's hard to see, like, what is, like, the sub, like, what's under the radar there. But I do feel like maybe Thieves Like Us gets lost a little bit in the shuffle there. And it's kind of like his take on Lovers on the Lamb movie. And you know, in true Altman fashion, it's not what you expect from that. It focuses on things that you don't think that such a movie would do. It's got a really sweet relationship between Keith Carradine and Shelley Duvall's characters. I think it's a gem, gentlemen, a gem, I guess is one way.
I know it's a gem because that was going to be my pick as well.
Oh, no, well, I think it also makes a great double feature with They Live by Night, the Nicholas Ray version adaptation of the same novel, and extremely different film. So if I stole that from you,
yeah,
I don't know what I'm supposed to do.
I'll just let you have it.
Supposed to champion Buffalo Bill and the Indians or Sitting Bull's history lesson.
Secret honor. Let's just say secret honor, or we'll say Cookie's Fortune. How about Cookie's Fortune? That's a good one.
We're all kind of roughly the same age, and so I think we all kind of remember that moment when a lot of the Altman films that for the longest time you could not find in the video store started showing up. Thieves Like Us being a case in point.
California Split, man. That was California Split. That was a white whale for so long, and then I saw it like you're supposed to see it, like in Letterboxd, and it was just sensational.
And that's the thing. It's like he's like Leone. I think he's one of the directors that suffers the most from being cropped and panned and scanned, which Thieves Like Us is one you could watch in the VHS era. But I think it's like Nashville, I think, are kind of borderline incomprehensible without in the pre-Letterboxd era.
Yeah. And for the longest time, like the only Altman I could find in the video store were like the 80s films. Like those were easy to find. But the ones that were the classics, you know, Beyond Nashville and McCabe, Mrs. Miller and MASH, like even The Long Goodbye was not easy to locate when we were all growing up. So when Thieves Like Us became available, California Split now shows up on TCM all the time. Mm-hmm. I think I saw that like, you know, the Criterion Channel, like California Split and The Long Goodbye for a long time have been like two of their most popular movies whenever they're available on Criterion. So, I don't know. I mean, you know, they have staying power, these Altman
films. They do. Yeah. Well, I'll spare everyone the story of when I took my entire family to see Ready to Wear on Christmas Day. It went over better than you might expect, actually. I know it wasn't one of those they ridiculed me for.
Yeah, does not hold up. I'm an Altman apologist. I love Dr. Keegan the Women. I will not stand up for Ready to Wear.
Okay.
Well, it does have a line like someone's, I forget which character says, that like that we have some of our best fashion doctors on it. It's a line that always makes me laugh. But yeah. It's a rough one.
The Long Goodbye used to be one of those hidden Altman gems, but now it feels canonical. Keith, want to tell our listeners why we're coming back to it for this set of episodes?
Sure. You may not know it based on the half-hearted marketing campaign, but there's a new Fletch movie for the first time since Chevy Chase played the role twice in the 1980s. But with Day Trippers director Greg Mottola behind the camera and John Hamm in the title role, Confess Fletch has a low-key Shaggy Dog quality that's more in keeping with Gregory MacDonald's original novels. Mottola's offbeat approach to the gumshoe thriller has less in common with the 1985 Fletch than it does with a film like The Long Goodbye, a California noir in which Elliot Gould plays Philip Marlowe as a chain-smoking private detective who's like a magnet for trouble, but that's okay with him.
So this week, we'll follow Marlowe as he lopes around from an all-night grocery store to the beaches of Malibu to Mexico City and gets to the bottom of a surprisingly complex mystery. Then we'll follow Irwin Fletcher from Rome to Boston as he untangles an art robbery and tries to get himself acquitted from a murder rap. Keith and I are going to pause for a moment to crack open a can of very specific food for our cats, but we'll talk Altman after the break.
Invites your eye to come her way.
There's gonna be a lot of people looking for me as a result of my lovely wife.
If it was a murderer, he murdered his wife.
That's a lie. I know he didn't kill her.
It's a minor crime, a misdemeanor to kill your wife. The major crime is he stole my money. Your friend stole my money, and the penalty for that is capital punishment.
Even as she smiles a quick hello, you let her go.
I like your face, too. Could you find my husband for me, please, Mr. Marlowe?
You let the moment fly.
I'm a man cannot stand confinement.
Who the hell are you?
Well, I'm this here private investigator who was sent here this afternoon to find you.
Did you come here to see me or my wife?
It's not his business.
Write the check, Roger.
What check?
Write the check, Roger.
Whoa.
Lady, you turn your head. You know you said a long goodbye.
Never learn. You're a born loser.
What do you think, Mabel?
Ow!
If you have any trouble, I'll back you up.
I have fresh evidence now for you to reopen the Terry Lennox case.
You ever think about suicide, Marlboro?
Me? I don't believe in it.
Director Robert Altman reportedly did not even finish reading Raymond Chandler's The Long Goodbye in the lead-up to making the film, though he did commission Lee Brackett, who'd helped adapt Chandler's The Big Sleep for Howard Hawks, to write the screenplay. Quote, "I read the end of the book in the beginning," Altman said, "but I didn't read it all the way through," end quote. Instead, he gave copies of Raymond Chandler speaking, the book, to the cast and crew and wanted them to read through Chandler's literary essays. Altman's biographer, Patrick McGilligan, put it this way in his book Jumping Off the Cliff, quote, "As always with Altman, Chandler was not the point so much as a means to a certain end," end quote. Altman anticipated that Chandler fans would reject The Long Goodbye, particularly his conception of Philip Marlowe as what he called, quote-unquote, Rip Van Marlowe, a bedraggled loser who seems to fumble his way to the bottom of a case, despite having much keener instincts than his passive demeanor might suggest. Chandler's conception of Marlowe wouldn't have a place in 1970s Hollywood, so Altman made him into a character who would. To quote the opening narration of the Coen brothers' The Big Lebowski, which owes a huge debt to Altman's film, quote, "Sometimes there's a man, well, he's a man for his time and place. He fits right in there. And that's the dude in Los Angeles," end quote. Replace the dude for Marlowe in the late 90s for the mid-70s, and the overall vibe is more or less the same. The Long Goodbye chooses to back into its mystery, which is both a fine indication of its intent and a reflection of the passivity that guides Elliot Gould's Marlowe. Before Marlowe gets embroiled in connected murder and missing person cases, he has to contend first with his needy cat, who's the only companion he has in his conspicuously shabby L.A. bachelor pad. It's 3 a.m., and the cat has awakened Rip Van Marlowe from his slumber, harassing him until it gets some Curry brand cat food. He tries to improvise dinner out of a plate of not-quite-spoiled cottage cheese, but the animal bats it off the counter, sending Marlowe out to a 24-hour grocery store in the middle of the night to get him his preferred food. When the store doesn't have Curry brand cat food, Marlowe asks the clerk about it. The clerk replies, "What do I need a cat for? I've got a girl." The indignities don't end for poor Marlowe there. The cat rejects his effort to sneak a different brand into a curry can, but trouble does finally arrive at his doorstep. His buddy Terry Lennox, played by ex-ball player and Ball 4 author Jim Booten, shows up asking for a ride to Tijuana, and Marlowe obliges, no questions asked. Upon his return, however, the police turn up to arrest Marlowe for aiding in Terry's escape. It turns out that Terry is suspected of murdering his rich wife, Sylvia. Marlowe gets released from jail a few days later, after Terry reportedly committed suicide in Mexico, but Marlowe doesn't believe that Terry is dead any more than he believes Terry killed his wife. Meanwhile, at the very same Malibu Beach community where Terry lived, Marlowe is hired by Eileen Wade, played by Nina Von Palant, to find her missing husband Roger, played by Sterling Hayden. A boozy, Hemingway-like author on a bad streak, Roger tends to slip off to rehab facilities every once in a while to dry himself out, but Eileen hasn't seen him in a week, and he doesn't appear to be in the usual places. While it doesn't take Marlowe long to find Roger at a local clinic, a whole host of odd characters start to surface, from Henry Gibson as a sketchy clinic doctor named Dr. Verringer, to Mark Rydell as a Jewish gangster named Marty Augustine. Not surprisingly, there are some connections to be found between Terry's case and the Wades. Photographed in a smoggy haze by Vilmos Zsigmond, a look that, on top of The Big Lebowski, had a great deal of impact on other films like Inherent Vice and Greenberg, The Long Goodbye is about vibes, as the kids today might say. Marlowe may be out of touch with post-hippie SoCal culture, as represented by the oft-naked yoga and pot enthusiast next door, but as he says, it's okay with me. He floats through Los Angeles as a detached commenter on his surroundings, and much of what he mumbles is hilariously observational. But he takes advantage of being underestimated, and nearly always has a better read on the situation than he lets on. That's the edge that being branded a loser gives him. He also cares even more than we in the audience might expect. When Marty Augustine maims his own girlfriend just to make a point, it rattles him. When he discovers what really happens to Terry, it enrages him. Maybe everything isn't okay with Marlowe. Maybe everything isn't okay with the 70s Hollywood culture in which he occupies. Perhaps Rip Von Marlowe has finally woken from his slumber. We'll talk about it after the break.
May I help you, please?
Yeah, I'm looking for a patient named Roger Wade.
There's no one here with that name.
Well, yeah, he may not be using that name. This is a picture of him. Do you recognize the face?
There's no one here that looks like that.
You look just like my great aunt Esther. She passed on a couple of years ago. Is Dr. Verringer around?
Dr. Verringer is out of town.
Out of town?
In Phoenix.
Phoenix, Arizona.
May I ask who you are?
Certainly. I'm just some guy looking for Dr. Verringer. Those ladies are a lot of help. Crazy ladies. It's okay with me.
So The Long Goodbye wasn't very well received when it came out, but now it's widely acknowledged as part of Altman's peak creative period in the early to mid-1970s. How do you account for the journey the film's reputation has taken?
I think it's a couple of reasons. For one thing, this, weirdly enough, is one of the more accessible, I think, Altman films, because for all the liberties that he takes with the detective genre and the gumshoe hero, I do think that he actually does more or less follow a lot of Raymond Chandler's original plot. So there is a story. And Altman is not super into story. I mean, he's often said, or he did when he was alive, he often said that he preferred, you know, behavior. He was fascinated by humans and what they did more so than he was in, you know, stories that were being told. But he nevertheless, you know, kind of hewed to, or at least he and I guess the screenwriter, is that Lee Brackett who did the screenplay for this? You know, hewed to, you know, the book. And so there is actually a mystery there. And one of the great things about detective stories is that you can do a lot with those kind of stories because you have the hook of whodunit or why do they do it or how do they do it, whatever it might be. You have that mystery that can kind of pull people along. And so all the Altman touches are in The Long Goodbye, but they're yoked to something where people can actually follow a story all the way through to the end. And I will add one more thing. This kind of came in the period where he was doing sort of genre deconstructions almost like once a year, essentially. He did his Western with McCabe and Mrs. Miller. He did, you know, his detective story with The Long Goodbye, the gangster movie with Thieves Like Us, like Keith mentioned. And so, you know, that also was kind of a hook that Altman was able to provide for that, you know, 1970s period where he took, you know, very familiar genres and put his own spin on them, his own kind of like knuckling spin on the films.
Yeah.
I think in terms of why it wasn't that well received, I think it might just been a matter of Altman's kind of flooding the zone after MASH. I mean, there's just movie after movie. And like MASH was a huge popular success. And then, you know, it's followed by Brewster McCloud. And like, you know, if you're a MASH fan who shows up for more of the same and you get Brewster McCloud, really one of the most peculiar films in his filmography, or really anyone's filmography, I think, then you're going to be confused. I mean, Images is basically an experimental film. I like that movie a lot, but you can see why that would not be a hit with audiences. I think also I feel like Elliot Gould's star, if I'm not wrong, had kind of cooled a little bit at this point. Like he had kind of picked up a reputation as being difficult, and some of his films had not been, you know, post MASH had not been a huge success. So I can see why maybe you're going to run into that to that issue, but I don't know. It's a pretty great movie.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. I mean, the Gould thing is definitely true. It actually took quite a bit of doing just to get him cast in that role, because there was a lot of distrust about whether he had the mental capacity to pull off the role. But of course, Altman felt strongly that he could play the role well, and he was certainly right in that. I mean, I think maybe with Altman, and it's just, I mean, Altman is somebody who's going to do everything differently than you might expect, and filmmakers who do that, who shake up expectations, their films are not necessarily going to be loved right away. Maybe that's kind of what happened here, as it happened with other films in his career. And, you know, certainly filmmakers, Kubrick being another, who just, you know, they're kind of ahead of the curve on with their own work. And it just kind of takes people a little bit of time to catch up. But I think Noel is also right that The Long Goodbye is not a difficult sit, really. It's fun. It's easy to follow for this type of a story. It's so it is kind of surprising that it didn't, connect right away because I think it's a good time, but maybe that's just me. Also, I feel like even though a lot of that Marlowe's dialogue is mumbly, that's part of his character. This is not a case either where the soundtrack is terribly muddy in terms of a lot of voices being laid on top of each other. It's a fairly clean recording by his standards.
I've read a lot of stories about how these films from all of them were released, and there's all kinds of bad luck involved. Like, when Booster McCloud came out, they actually debuted it at the Astrodome and no one could hear a damn thing. Mm-hmm. It was in this big arena. It's probably hard enough to hear his films anyway. I remember seeing McCabe and Mrs. Miller once at a festival in a big library, and you literally could not hear a single line of dialogue in that film, which is already a very murky, audio track to begin with. And then that was similarly, McCabe and Mrs. Miller, had a bad rollout because people couldn't hear the dialogue. And I think with Long Goodbye, my memory is that it was initially not really even released in New York, which is where you need to kind of have, the critics coalesce around it, the Pauline Kaels, et cetera. Mm-hmm. And the marketing changed for that film halfway through. The famous sort of Jack Davis poster for the film that makes it look more like kind of a, Animal House-like raucous comedy was the second marketing attempt. And that actually was more successful than the first poster, which made it look more like a conventional private eye film.
Huh, that's interesting.
Is New York much of a movie town, though? I mean, do people are they into films there?
So maybe the good place to start with the film is Altman and Gould's conception of Marlowe, because this is one that deviates pretty strongly, or this is a Marlowe, I suppose, for the times, as I said in the keynote. That opening, of course, borrowed heavily in a film like The Big Lebowski. Really sort of he's a man for his time and his place, Marlowe. So what did you make of this conception of that character?
It's weird because it is a very 70s version of this detective, in the sense that he is existing in a world of hippies, and he's kind of hesitant. He's part of a different kind of culture, but at the same time, I think the original idea that Altman had for this character was that he would literally have been somebody who had been asleep.
Right.
For 30 years, that it was sort of
Rip Van Winkle.
Exactly. Right. He woke up. He was the actual original Marlowe who fell asleep in the 40s or 50s and woke up in the 70s and is like, all right. Okay. I mean, which is like, it's okay by me. That's what he says over and over again. And he's just trying to get along. And obviously, Altman tried throughout the film to contrast this version of Marlowe with, the conventional Hollywood version. I mean, there's a lot of Hollywood stuff in this film, from Hooray for Hollywood, which plays at the beginning and the end. There are characters who imitate classic Hollywood actors.
Yes.
There's this sense that the world has changed since the time that Marlowe was around. But I think in the end it's really not that far removed, aside from the fact that he's not essentially a man of action until the very end. Other than that, most detectives, if you read classic detective fiction, do kind of have this sort of hipster, I understand what the world is more than anybody else does, and I'm kind of gliding through it, doing my thing.
Laconic, I guess, is the...
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, I think it's the kind of detachment and jadedness you would expect from Chandler's books, but kind of with a smile, I guess, and a sort of the much repeated "it's okay by me," attitude. But I do like that it does, for all its deconstructions of the genre, it works as a detective movie, as we said before. And I mean, Marlon's a really good detective. Like when he's questioning Eileen at the beach house, he just kind of snaps to attention and comes into focus, and you realize, it's not Columbo, but it's not that far removed from Columbo, where you get this feeling of someone whose wheels have been spinning the entire time, even if that's not necessarily evident from the outside.
Well, he has an excellent read on almost every situation. The only thing he does that he's late to get a real read on is his friend, Terry. He doesn't believe that Terry is capable of doing the things that Terry proved himself capable of doing. But in every other respect, when he goes to find you know, Roger at the clinic and just kind of gets a sense of the room and is like, okay, he's here. So I'm just going to go walk back and find him. You know, there's like, you know, or I'm going to hide this bush because I know I'm going to get information that I need here. And I mean, I think that that's part of a strategy in a way, because people just take him for granted. They assume that he's less of a threat, less wily than he turns out to be. And I think Terry makes an extremely poor assumption, maybe we do too, about what he's capable of at the very end. But you know, one thing I will say though, that again, I'm not hugely familiar with a literary version of Marlowe, but I think there is some effort made here to paint him as kind of a loser. I mean, this is not his bachelor pad is not well appointed. You know, I mean, we see him working.
Great view. Let's give him that.
Right. Yes, it does have. It really is. I mean, it's a cool. It could be a cool place. It's got potential, but he's not realized that potential. Great neighbors. You can't beat the anyway. But no. But he's also got. He's got these walls that are lined with the streaks of him lighting his matches. He's got. You know. When we first see him, he's waking up. He's being woken up by his cat at 3 o'clock in the morning, and he goes through this incredible charade where he's trying to fool the cat into thinking that he's getting his curry bread cat food, which is just wonderful. And I love it, but I love that the, you know, that there's so much time devoted to that specific thing before you get to anything pertinent. I mean, you get some images of Terry to kind of prime that particular pump, but mostly it's really about establishing Marlowe as a character. And so he does it entirely through this, his relationship with his cat, who's terrific. That's a great cat performance. I don't know how you get any performance out of a cat. If you had a cat, it's impossible, but I love it. And I think that line from the clerk, you know, what do I need a cat for? I've got a girl is, that is what they call a sick burn. They call that back in the 70s. They used to call it a sick burn. I mean, I think it really does try to sketch him, not just as Rip Von Marlowe, but as somebody who is not one of the winners, not one of society's winners, really, the way he kind of lives his life. But
I think part of what makes Marlowe and his descendants who they are is like they're losers with integrity, and they're losers because of their integrity. I feel like you know, this is someone who, you know, it's a world where anyone with money is suspect. They're you know, morally suspect, just because the things you need to do to get money, the things you need to do to live in that Malibu colony, aren't nice things, you know. And certainly that's a noir trope. It may be a real life trope as well, but I think, you know, Marlowe's someone who has to stay outside that system.
Yeah, and that's kind of common to detective stories in general. That's why I love them. It's like detectives can sort of go anywhere. They can dwell among the rich. They can also go down to the lowest possible person who can give them the real information of what's going on. So yeah, I think this is actually very true, once again, to, you know, the whole concept of the private investigator is that he may not be among the rich, but he understands the rich, just like he understands the person working the door at any particular place. He knows what they know as well. The bartenders, the doormen, the cabbies, you know, all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, and I mean, and I think that's been a traditional function of a lot of noirs and procedurals is because you can follow this character, they can reveal the world of the film to you that way, which is what Altman is all about. Yeah, you know, so how do you, I guess, on that front, I mean, where do you see this film's place in the tradition of detective movies and film noirs? Like, what's Altman trying to pull off with this?
Well, I mean, what's funny is it's less, I think, I mean, there is sort of a basic noirish concept, which is that, you know, most noir films are about that there is some sort of stain on every human being, and they can go through their entire life without having any realization that they have that stain in front of them until something happens. There's some inciting incident. There's a murder, there's a crime, they're wrongly accused, you know, whatever it might be. And that's the moment when they realize that everything that they thought was correct was wrong the whole time, and that kind of shakes them up. Now, I would not say that's necessarily true of Marlowe, who kind of, I think, understands, you know, who he is and the world that he lives in, but certainly the people that he's investigating, everybody seemed to be cruising along just okay, you know, until everything kind of went haywire. And so that's kind of what he's sort of the agent who comes along and exposes everything that is wrong. So that's the connection to the past. What I find more fascinating, you know, Altman, for all of the fact that, you know, his films were not extraordinarily popular at the time, with the exception of MASH and Nashville. The influence that he had on popular culture is, I think, seen, if you're somebody who watched a lot of 70s movies, much more so than you might imagine. You watch like Spielberg films, for example, and you can, the early Spielberg films, you watch Jaws or Sugarland Express, and you hear the overlapping dialogue of Altman, you know, in those films. And when you watch television in the 70s, when you watch Banachek, you watch The Rockford Files, you watch Columbo, I think you sort of see that, you know, long goodbye sort of style. You see that sort of rumpled detective kind of dealing with the world in a very laid back, laconic way, you know, without the two-fisted action. I think that's the long goodbye. I think you see that almost as much on television detective movies, TV shows, than you do in movies.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's just a more freedom just to loosen up a little bit.
Yeah.
Right? It kind of, you know, kind of get a little bit more of the environment, not really having to, you know, paint by the numbers so much. But that's interesting. It's interesting to think about it as the influences being that immediate because, you know, as I said in the keynote, you know, a film like The Long Goodbye is massively influential to a lot of films that we've seen, you know, within the 21st century, and Inherent Vice being a major one, even something like Greenberg. I think the way Greenberg kind of looks and feels very Long Goodbye like to me, even though it's not really a noir, but it's ended up becoming kind of one of his big major works in that respect. So I mean, we have Gould's performance in this film, but we have a lot of other supporting performances as well in this film that are quite intriguing and surprising. I mean, and you know, I don't think we expect, you know, Jim Bouton, the author of Ball 4 and of Ex Ball Player, to turn up as Terry. That's quite interesting. You have a director, Mark Rydell, playing the Jewish gangster Marty Augustine, and of course Sterling Hayden, really surprising person to have in a Robert Altman film, and apparently Altman absolutely loved him. So yeah. Which I would have expected, given politically, I would have thought those two would be at such loggerheads that it would have been like a night, like it feels, since it'd be like Sterling Hayden, it would be like the perfect example of somebody who would be absolutely irritated by having to be in a Robert Altman movie. But maybe not.
I know that character, yeah, kind of reads as Hemingway, but I kept thinking he's kind of doing John Huston, who, of course, he would be very familiar with because of The Asphalt Jungle. But like the vocal inflections and, you know, the beard and everything, it kind of plays a lot like, you know, what we think of when we think of John Huston. Maybe that's just me. Maybe that was just me picking up on things that aren't actually there.
No, I think it echoes a little bit with Chinatown, you know, 2 years later, with John Huston playing kind of a similar sort of patriarchal older character that is.
I mostly meant the drunkenness, Noel, but yeah, I guess you're right.
It also kind of reminds me a little bit of Barton Fink, of the John Mahoney's, you know, conception of, I guess, William Faulkner or whoever it was he was playing there.
Yeah, well, and I think Hayden has, I mean, not only the size, but the you know, the beard and everything. I mean, it's just, you know, I think he was encouraged to really lean into how intimidatingly large he is and kind of frightening, which then, you know, also ends up surprising you with the amount of, you know, vulnerability there's kind of a soft underbelly to that character as well that becomes surprising, as, you know, frightening as a figure as he appears to be.
I really like Henry Gibson. I mean, I always like Henry Gibson, but it takes something to make Gibson feel scary and intimidating, particularly next to much taller people, which is basically everyone else in the film. But when he shows up, it's really, especially when he shows up at the party in that one scene, it's disconcerting. He has like such a focused intent and seriousness of purpose that he's a little, it's kind of like when Don Rickles shows up in Casino. It's like, you know, you know, it's Don Rickles, but for some reason he's scary. It's kind of the same thing here.
Yeah, he does not care what people are going to think about him as he walks up and, like, you know, intimidates people. Whatever power he has, either over the people that are in his circle or with money or whatever it might be. It's amazing to me that, you know, that Altman was able to find some of these folks and kind of, you know, bend them into his movies and use them in ways that they were never really used any other way. A lot of them were TV actors. And he found something in them that he could use to, you know, fit into his little, you know, alongside people like Mark Rydell or Jim Bouton, I mean, people that do not belong in movies, or Nina Van Pallant, who was at the time, I guess, most famous for being the the lover of, you know, the guy who faked the Howard Hughes diaries. You know, that's all she was known for. And he fits her into this movie somehow. And then he fits them alongside people like Henry Gibson and Hollywood legends like Sterling Hayden. It's kind of, you know, there's something about his methods where he's just able to kind of put people together like a party and just move his camera around and follow what's going on in the party.
Yep. Arnold Schwarzenegger as well. He can't, that's a nice, biggest star in the film. He doesn't get a line or he's not credited, but he's there. David Carradine is the bunk mate of Marlowe's in prison, has a really nice uncredited thing where he does speak. He doesn't give, unlike Arnold, who just really needs to, you know, be shirtless at one point and be the ultimate henchman. But yeah, I mean, it's wonderful. And I do love that Henry Gibson performance, because I think that is a character who could very easily be turned into a fool. You know, and you do get a really funny line where about he's been searching, where Marlowe's been searching for Dr. Verringer, and a bunch of patients all at once say, "Hello, Dr. Verringer." But you know, again, he's kind of unfazed by that, and he does have a certain menace. And it made me think, like, what's this operation all about? I mean, there's a lot more happening here that we're really not, you know, we're only getting a small glimpse of it. And also just to take the time, and this speaks to the comedy of the film, which is quite strong. I mean, I think this film is really funny. The security guard who does impressions, that's comic gold every single time. Particularly the moment where Marlowe says that the guy in the car behind him is really into Walter Brennan. Oh, that's he does a great impression. It gets a very cold response, to their impression, but I love it. So what do you think of the women in this film and about Marlowe's feelings towards them? I mean, he doesn't have a girl like the grocery clerk does, but he does seem to have them on his mind.
Yeah, well, I mean, of course, you know, he walks out of his door and he sees women doing naked yoga, like, you know, right there. So, I think that what is interesting about the way this film approaches women in detective stories and noir stories is that it sort of exposes the kind of underlying violence towards women that was frequently, you know, seen in these films, but not really commented on. Obviously, one of the most famous scenes in the film is where Mark Rydell's character, you know, smashes a Coke bottle, you know, in a woman's face, you know, and says that I love her and what would I do to you, you know, if I did this? You know, the idea that women are sort of props, you know, they're props for the story. And I think that that's not uncommon in these kind of films, but I think that this movie actually sort of draws attention to the fact that they are not active, you know, I guess today would say they don't have agency. It's not really their place. And, you know, I find that very interesting because, you know, comparing to a lot of his peers, I think Altman was always very good about giving women, you know, more room to move in his films. Like his female characters have dimension and life in a way that, like, they don't necessarily have in, say, not to, you know, cast aspersions, but on maybe Steven Spielberg's films, for example, or someone from the, you know, the same general era. Mm-hmm. But not so much in this film, and I think it's on purpose. I don't think it is an oversight. I think it actually is part of what the point of the film is.
Right. Well, Mash was would be an exception in terms
of talking about.
Just to go back to some one of our more contentious episodes of the show,
we don't talk about Mash on the next.
But
I mean,
you can't say. Well, you wouldn't say that about it. But you're talking about three women in Nashville and all these other things. It's a different story. McKay, Mrs. Miller, incredible character, for sure.
That Coke bottle moment is so bracing. I think you're onto something, Scott, where it's like, you know, the violence, that kind of violence tends to be more stylized or to happen off screen in noirs. And it is such a, you know, we've had like, it is a fairly tense but low key confrontation until that moment, which is totally kind of changes the stakes of the film. I think Eileen too is an interesting femme fatale in that she doesn't have any of the qualities of femme fatale, but she's still plays a role and you know, we get to that final scene where, you know, kind of confirms her involvement in everything as well. She seems like, you know, he seems very protective of her in many ways. Like the scene after Sterling Hayden's character dies, he's very, like I said, protective of her, but for all the wrong reasons in a way.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's kind of why one of the reasons why I asked this question is because I think it is almost as a lead into the end of the film, because I think it's surprising based on what we think we understand about Marlowe that he would take the action that he does against Terry. And I almost feel like it's informed by these experiences he's had with women. I feel like there's a certain buildup of, I mean, obviously he's very angry with his friend for this terrible betrayal, but I think there's kind of a lot of abuse that he has kind of witnessed, and murder and and violence. I feel like all of that kind of builds up, to this moment where he just shoots him dead. What did you think of the ending of this movie?
I find it really heartbreaking. I've this is someone who is jaded and cynical, but not without attachments. I mean, this is the only person we really see him have, having a friend, a true friend. I mean, he's nice to people at the bar, but I get the feeling that's a fairly, casual relationship. I mean, he develops feelings for Eileen and kind of like in the end, he has nothing to hold on to. He doesn't even have his cat, as he says. everything's gone.
Yeah. I mean, they put that sort of ironic ending at the, where he walks down the pathway and Hooray for Hollywood, plays once again, but it can't really mask the fact that that was a really sort of tragic moment for him, that he had to, whether he had to or not, he felt compelled to pull the trigger. It's very sad.
Yeah, I mean, though it is kind of odd, that last bit, because there is something, there's this reintroduction of lightness to the very, very end of the film that does kind of contrast with what he's just done. He just sort of wanders off and he gets passed in the car by Eileen, and he breaks out the harmonica that he's gotten from the from the man at the hospital. That is kind of an odd touch, though. I think it's another case where the end of that film, just the setting of it, is so vivid for some, you can forget everything visually. I mean, it's Vilmos Zsigmond does an absolutely terrific job of filming this film throughout, but like the two sequences that stand out to me and that are always in my head when I think about The Long Goodbye is the ending and walking along that pathway, and then of course the scene at the Wade's beach house where you get multiple images being kind of through the that are we see reflections through the window, and it's so gorgeous. I don't even know what to say about
that's that's one of the most Altman-y moments in the film, is the seeing things through the window. Windows and reflections are a huge part of his mise-en-scene, so yeah.
Oh man, it is really just on a pure filmic level something to behold, both of those sequences.
As for the ending, I feel like him kind of picking up the Devil May Care attitude and playing the harmonica, I think it's kind of, in some ways, it's a little bit of a, I don't want to say happy ending, but it is Marlowe remains Marlowe. He's been to the bottom, but he's going to remain essentially the same person. It's also, just because I just watched it again, but it's the third man, right? I mean, it's kind of the same, even set up to look like the third man.
Yeah. And Wells is one of Altman's heroes. He doesn't really talk too much in his, interviews and things about filmmakers that he was a huge fan of, but I know that he loved Wells. He liked people who tried to make the frame come alive. I remember I interviewed him once, and I've read lots of things about him, about his work. And one of the reasons he moved the camera all the time is that he felt like he had to. He felt like otherwise it was just a box. He wanted to explore the box. He wanted to explore the space. Mm-hmm. And so moving the camera, putting things, in different planes, forward and backward, these were all the things he found made a movie a movie, and wasn't just, something static. So yeah, definitely. Third man's a key thing for him, I think.
It's interesting how willing he is to just throw away a lot of stuff that people would cling to in making a movie like this, like the book. I mean, like coming out and admitting, hey, I read the beginning and the end, and you know, and or just, you know, having to kind of rework the end the way he wanted to do it, and or, you know, having a lot of staging the scenes between Hayden and Gould in kind of an improvisatory way. I mean, there's a lot of things that he just is willing to experiment on. You know, he's gives you that impression of a artist who goes in with as few preconceived notions as possible, or at least allows himself some room to kind of like paint really on the spot, which is just not a comfortable way of doing film production. You're supposed to be prepared and know what every shot's going to be, and there's kind of a level, there's an element of spontaneity and intuitiveness and curiosity to Altman's work that does make it lively.
Yeah, I mean, he could be a little disingenuous about that. I think, like, at times he talks about how, oh, we didn't really have a script, or we didn't really. And I think a lot of people who worked with him would say that, you know, that that's a little insulting.
right.
You know, particularly the name's flown out of my head, but the screenwriter of Nashville. Joan Tewksbury, the Nashville and Thieves Like Us. I mean, she did a lot of work with him. And those were, you know, she wrote those movies. I mean, you know, there's improvisation, but, you know, there's also a structure. And I think, like I said, I think Long Goodbye actually does sort of follow the book in a lot of ways, even though there's things that are moved around. I think Lee Brackett's contributions are a little underrated.
She really enjoyed her experiences with Altman. I did read that piece of his biography, and she seemed to really like the process. She liked Images, like big fan of Images, was like ready to, you know, she was interestingly flexible thinker, you know.
Yeah, but you're right. I mean, he did like improvise on the spot and try to think what would work at the moment, you know. I think the problem that Altman would have post Nashville is that frequently he would just assume that, oh, I got a great idea. I've got every actor in Hollywood wants to work with me. Let's all get together and just see what happens. And then it turns into Buffalo Bill and the Indians, or A Wedding, or Health. Movies that are fine. I mean, they have their moments, you know, or much later in his career, you know, Ready to Wear. But you can tell that like about 2/3 of the way through, he realized, yeah, this isn't really working. But I've got another movie lined up for 2 months from now, so let's just wrap this up.
Yeah. Well, there's there's kind of a lack of architecture there. You need a little bit of architecture, a little bit of structure, a little bit of direction in order for the rest of the stuff to kind of work around it, rather than just like, if you get too, you know, wishy-washy in terms of the conceit, then things can kind of get out of control.
Yeah, so again, when you look at what movies of his that actually work and why they work, I think you have to look at something like The Long Goodbye, and it's all those things we talked about. It's the fact that it has some sort of a structure, and it has these, you know, memorable characters, some of which are from Marlowe, I mean, some of which are from Chandler, some of which are from, you know, the actors doing their own individual spins on it. So, I mean, you know, it's an Altman film through and through. But the Altman films that work, I think, have, you know, full buy-in from multiple people. I mean, I haven't even mentioned, real quick before we move on, I know we're running out of time, but two names that we need to mention. You mentioned Vilma Zsigmond earlier, mm-hmm. but we need to mention him again, because, you know, the look of that film, which I think he describes in the commentary track on the DVD as being like trying to look like old faded postcards of Los Angeles. That's what he was trying to get across.
Oh yeah.
And that's just amazing. And the other is we haven't mentioned John Williams.
I know. The different versions of The Long Goodbye are so great. It's one of the best.
I mean, it's wild to think about John Williams' career as somebody who, you know, became known as the go-to guy for Spielberg and Lucas and these huge blockbusters. But early in his career, he's working with Altman and De Palma and doing these like really weird pastiche things. And
his squirting Images is really aggressively avant-garde too. It's not what you think of as John Williams at all.
Yeah, he was a new Hollywood auteur as much as, you know, any of those guys in his own way for a time.
Zsigmond's great, and Zsigmond, I mean, he just kept working to do, like, it's like, I don't know if some of his last work was on the Mindy projects. I like the idea of someone who is just so dedicated to just showing up and doing a job. It's like, okay, yeah, you want to work with me, Vilma Zsigmond, to shoot your sitcom? I'll do that.
Well, we'll get a chance to talk more Zsigmond and more Altman on our next episode when we bring in Confess Fletch. But until then, we'd love to hear your thoughts on this discussion and anything else in the world of film. Email us at comments@nextpictureshow.net if you want to share any responses with us and other listeners, or leave us a voicemail at 773-234-9730. We'll be back in a minute with some feedback. Now it's time for feedback. A few weeks ago, we did an episode on The Thief of Baghdad, but our discussion did not touch on the actor who played the djinn in that one. Keith, could you read this letter from Ian?
Sure. I enjoyed this episode, but unless I missed it, none of you spoke the name of Rex Ingram, who played the djinn, and instead it seemed to treat the character as a special effect rather than a performance. I know it wasn't intentional, but this doesn't seem a very respectful way to treat one of the most acclaimed African-American film and theater actors of the 1930s and 1940s, and the only person of color other than Sabu to have a major role in the film. Rex Ingram has significant roles in two pioneering black musicals, playing Adam and Dalaud in Green Pastures, and the latter's opposite number, Lucifer Jr. in Cabin in the Sky. He is terrific as Sudan Defense Force Sergeant Major Tambul in Zoltan Korda's 1943 film Sahara, who first enters the film with sympathetic Italian prisoner J. Carroll Nash in tow. Nash got an Oscar nomination. Ingram should have. After a captured Nazi captain kills the Italian soldier for denouncing fascism and not helping him escape, Tambul tracks down and kills the Nazi before he can give away the position of Humphrey Bogart's tank to the German battalion searching for them. His djinn is, with Sabu's Abu, the best remembered performance in Thief of Baghdad, and was so popular that he essentially recreated the role in 1945's 1001 Nights, in which Cornel Wilde played Aladdin, and Phil Silvers, believe it or not, was his pickpocket sidekick, Abdullah. I love you guys, and I hope you did at least say his name, and I missed it. We didn't, and I'm sorry, no. And you know what? Yes. I meant to, because I was really taken with that performance, but I mean, I not to make excuses, but in the give and take of podcasting, sometimes you come in with things you want to talk about, and you just don't get to them. That is a big oversight. And I was, you know, certainly intrigued by this letter to seek out more of his films that I have not seen. So I feel like your very detailed, you know, the description of highlights from his career, hopefully will make up for that oversight. So yes, you know, hats off to Rex Ingram, who is terrific in this film. And, you know, our apologies for all the Ingram fans out there who noticed the oversight.
Yeah, and I did really enjoy the back and forth between those two characters. I mean, it is one of the wonderful comic moments in the movie when Sabu gives the djinn the business a little bit, and I think there's a lot to this performance of Rex Ingram. So I think we're just going to take the hit on this one. Mm-hmm. It was a name and a performance that we did not.
I will say though, he Ingram doesn't get credit for the giant foot. That is a special effect and one of my favorite special effects in the film. But for the rest of the performance, it's all his.
Yes, yeah. The foot is a lie, but the performance is the truth. So we always appreciate when our listeners share their thoughts and their recommendations. If you feel so inclined, we can feature your response on a future episode. To reach us, you can leave a short voicemail at 773-234-9730 or email us at comments@nextpictureshow.net. That's it for this episode of The Next Picture Show. In our next episode, we'll watch another wily slacker fumble his way through a mystery and confess Fletch. Look for that episode next Tuesday on your podcatcher of choice. For ad-free versions of the podcast and extra content, find us at Patreon at patreon.com/nextpictureshow. You can find us at nextpictureshow.net and on Twitter at nextpicturepod if you want to keep track of when new episodes drop. Until next week, work on your Walter Brennan impression. The guy in the podcast behind us is a big fan.
Don't you try to be nice to me now. I'm leaving, and it's goodbye. I ain't running after you in the rain when you're catching a plane. No more. Goodbye, goodbye, goodbye. I'm through this time, and I mean it. In fact, I don't know if I ever even did like you, except for your body. Your body was good. Well, let's say so long.